Well, okay. This may or may not happen, and let's go ahead and talk, and we have the lights back on while I'm doing this portion.
You have to have that all before, this has to be prepared before you turn that on.
I have experience with students a lot, so I'm not worried. How is science possible?
That has to be cut on first.
Many people have kind of made reflections on
this should be fine.
What does it take to get science up and running? We all take science for granted now. It's a huge part of our life, a huge contribution. The products of science work so well. They enhance our lives. But what does it take to get science, what we call science today, mathematical, mechanical style explanation, take to have that happen? And it turns out, if you ask that question and probe it just a little bit, not every way of looking at the world, not every worldview is equally suited to kind of provide the support for science. Some work better than others. It's kind of a puzzle, actually. E.O. Wilson asked this. I have his quote. I promise I do. It's an awesome, powerful presentation. But he asked the question, why not China? Why not China? You know, if you survey the civilizations of the world in about 1000 AD, is there any measure whereby China would not be the world leader? They had better bureaucracy, better government, generally, better education system. I mean, they had a literal system of like the ACT of finding out who's the smartest student in each village and bringing them in to give them education to put them into the bureaucratic classes. They had incredible technology. Printing, including whatever you were told, movable type, before anybody in the West thought they had chemistry, including gunpowder, before we thought they had indoor plumbing when we were using trenches. I mean, it's just, you can go on and on and on and on. Why isn't China the culture that gives the world what we now call the scientific revolution? Copernicus, Kepler, Galileo, Newton, Boyle, all of the others. Because not every worldview is equally suited to provide what science needs to get up and running. And actually, you know, Wilson, in a book called Consilience, makes this point. He says, by about 1000, the Confucian scholars had given up the concept of God. There is some evidence that early Confucianists were. No. I'll keep looking up at that, so I keep saying, maybe?
They'll let you know.
Okay, you'll tell me. Okay, thank you. They had given up the concept of God, and he says, and really, without the idea of some underlying order stemming from the mind of God, the Chinese were very, very good at scooping up the surface order, the things that were readily apparent. But they didn't have much motivation or reason to look beneath the surface. Because there wasn't any reason to expect there to be any order very far beneath the surface. You know, here's what metals do, and we learn how to work them, and say, here's what chemicals do, and learn how to work them. There's no reason to look for a deep underlying theory that connects everything up to everything. One question I ask my students, how many of you have seen the movie The Matrix? Oh, okay, so that's pretty universal still. People have seen that. Would it make sense to do science if you thought you were living in the Matrix? Why not? What would be the problem? Well, you're living in the Matrix, but I mean, couldn't you do an original research, you know, from within the Matrix? Is that the reality is not really real. And so you never expect it to actually fit together on any deep level. It's enough of reality to keep you, you know, plugged in with the power plant or whatever the chemical element is. But there's no reason to expect it to be truly real. We actually think that that's part of the reason why science tapers off. We have some kind of high-fluted science in the Greek world and the Roman world. But because of, I think, Platonism and Neoplatonism, there was this sense that real reality is not the physical world. The physical world is kind of a shadow of the real reality. You can only approach truth by meditation and contemplation and so forth. And so they kind of, I think one of the things is it just kind of peters out to look for anything in the physical world, any deep connections. On the other hand, Christianity is the culture that gives rise
like
to science. It's weird to me to live, as I did, growing up in the 20th century and now living in the 21st century, to know that if I take a poll out on the street, most of the people I talk to will have some feeling that somehow science and religion are mortal enemies. They're the cobra and the mongoose. They're in, you know, a death struggle for all their existence, and one is going to end up eating the other. You know, I mean, that's kind of the way that it's pictured, but that's not true. Science, the way we practice it today, was produced by Christians in Christian Europe, in Christianized Europe. It's actually, many of the leading lights of science were Protestants, and the first great scientific society, the Royal Society in Great Britain, is, if you go through the list of the people who were part of that, many of them are names you might know, but many, many more are names that any reason to know. Again and again and again, they are of the part of Christianity in Great Britain that were protesting, were radical Christians in various ways. I mean, myself is a radical Christian, very conservative. You know, the Newton wrote more, way more, about the interpretation of the Book of Revelation. He has a whole mathematical formula all worked out to connect up Daniel, some bits of Ezekiel and Zechariah, and the Book of Revelation in order to do all that. He's fascinating. Incidentally, the earliest date that he thinks the second coming will occur is in 2062. If you thought people got excited about the money, you know, those of you who are going to be around in 2062, invest in Newton's dugongs because they will blow up around that time. It'll be awesome. Okay, he was fascinated by the Bible. His 50, actually thought he was going to be famous because of his commentary on Revelation. But that was going to make his name. And again and again and again, as you go through, you realize these are people of very deep. And it matters that they have very good faith. That's what helped them to get their Christianity up and running. There are kind of four assumptions that I want to talk us through tonight that science needs in order to function properly. And these are all assumptions you can't really justify from science itself. These have to come from outside. And in the case of actual science, they were supplied by the Christian world. Number one, why would you believe that the world has deep order? What makes you think that the world has deep order? Science requires, science functions on the concept that it's not just the surface order, the stuff you can see, the sun rises in the east, sets in the west, but that there are really deep order underneath, and you can connect up the dots to your life and order you want. Why would you believe it? Why do we believe that the world operates, you know, in a law-like way? Can I prove that the world is law? Can I go so far as to even prove one law of nature? Turns out you can't. We think about what it would take to prove something as simple as the law of gravity. What's going to happen if I let go of this? It's going to fall because the earth attracts the mass of these keys, and the keys actually attract the earth too, but the earth is much bigger, so the earth actually attracts these keys way stronger than my hand does, and so it's going to fall. The law of gravity doesn't just say that, though. What does it says, how many places does that relationship hold? Where mass, all mass attracts mass by this inverse square law. How many places does that hold? All the places. How many times does that hold? All the time. Does anybody have funding to test all that? No, we can't possibly. We don't prove laws in science, but that's not what science does. We can't prove that the world is law-like. That is an assumption that comes from our worldview, and it originally, I think, comes pretty clearly from the Christian worldview, that the world is orderly. Sometimes people say, well, yeah, but, you know, the proof is in the pudding. We worked on the assumption that the world is orderly, and it's worked, right? How's that for an argument? I can trust the idea that the world is orderly, because in the past, the concept that the world is orderly has worked. Let me ask you this. Would this be a good argument if I said to you, you know you can trust people with green eyes? You said, well, how do you know that? And I said, well, this girl over here, she has green eyes, and she told me I could. Is that a good argument? So, if you're questioning whether or not the world is orderly, is it the same kind of argument to say, how do we know the world is orderly? Well, because in the past, it always has been orderly. You see the problem? That argument would work if the world's orderly. That's a great argument. But if you're really questioning, you don't know whether the world's orderly or not, that is an absolutely circular argument, just like the first one. And that's kind of the problem. We don't have the resources to prove that the world is an orderly place. It's desperately needed. When I get into the lab, I've got to assume that there's order out there that we don't know about, that we'll be able to investigate, peel back the layers of reality, and find that order. I assume it's there. The original place that came from is from Christianity, and to this day, I think Christianity does a good job of supporting that concept of the order of the universe. Second is comprehensibility. What makes us think that the universe is comprehensible? Einstein famously said, the only thing that's incomprehensible about the universe is that it's comprehensible. Why would he say something? What do you think he was getting at?
When you got time and figured it out and found out that you're wrong.
What? No, he's talking about a much, much deeper problem, which is the universe almost acts like it sees us coming and prepares the way for us to know it. And it is a bizarre phenomenon that the universe opens itself to us. It would be so easy for the universe to be orderly even, and yet have an order that doesn't open itself to human understanding the way our universe does again and again and again and again and again. How many of you work crossword puzzles? Crossword? Okay, a few crossword. How do crosswords work? How do crossword puzzles work?
One letter at a time.
One letter at a time, one clue at a time, and those clues actually help you narrow down some of the other clues. You put this piece in place and this. That's totally the way science operates. Again and again and again. I can get this piece of data and this other piece of data, and that helps me to narrow down and say, well, it can't be this and this and this, or it might be this, and I try that out. Sure enough, it has one. Could you work a crossword puzzle with no clues? Just give you the puzzle, don't give you any of the clues.
You could.
You could, but we don't want. Because there is an answer, right? There is a right answer. There is a correct answer out there, but it would be so tedious. You know, if you just did it by, you could confirm you were right anyway. If you just did it by random chance, you don't live long enough as a human being. In fact, you don't live nearly long enough to even get one crossword puzzle by that methodology. The world could be like that easily. We can imagine many scenarios in which the fundamental things we need to be be able to figure out the world are just beyond us because of complexity or because of, it would be possible for things that are going on right here on this planet to vary based on some variables that are on the other side of the galaxy. And we're just not ever going to be in a position to observe those to figure that out. That's possible. That's not the way our universe is. And Einstein comments on that numerous times. He talks about God. He says, we're seeking the thoughts of the old one. That was one of his ways of talking about God. Now, I caution you, when Einstein talks about God, it is not very close to the God they're talking about. Just be aware of that. But he does need God to do this. For him, God is that which makes the universe comprehensible to science. And he needs God to function in that way, because otherwise it is a true mystery that the universe opens itself up to our ability to comprehend. It's kind of amazing. One of my favorite stories about this confidence in the comprehensibility of the universe, the rationality and comprehensibility of it, comes from the very early parts of the scientific revolution, Johannes Kepler. You guys know Kepler? What did he do? What's he famous for? There are moons named after him, but other than that, bigger deal than that. Anybody remember Johannes Kepler? Not the stars, but the planets. He's the first person to give us a mathematical description of how planets orbit that comes much, much closer to what we believe is true today. Up to Kepler, everybody thought that planets and everything else in the sky had to move in circles. Because that's the way it looks. It looks like the sun's moving in a big circle. Looks like the moon's moving in a big circle. The stars look like that. And so everybody assumed stuff in the sky moves in circles. He had inherited from Tycho Brahe this incredibly precise set of measurements of the movements of the planet Mars. About as precise as you could do without actual telescopes, which Tycho Brahe did not have. And so these incredible, over 3 years, these very precise measurements of where is the planet Mars. And he works, he takes that data, and he works for 4 years trying to get that to fit fact. I think it was 5 years, actually. Trying to get it to fit into a circular orbit. If I imagine that I'm orbiting around the sun, and I imagine that Mars is orbiting around the sun, what kind of orbits would we have to speculate about in order to get Mars to look the way it looks from all the measurements that we were able to take over those 3 years? 5 years he works. In the end, he has a circular theory, which gets accuracy is essentially 0.0004%. That's his deviation from true accuracy. Any of you do math that's accurate to more than 0.0004%? I mean, if that was me, I would have said, publish it, finish it, I'm going to go fishing. I'm about to do something else. Kepler knew that the data was about essentially twice as accurate as what his model was. 5 years he worked. 5 years. Threw it all out. Started over again. He said, I cannot make it work with the surface. What Mars is doing and what Earth is doing is not circular. And so he comes to this concept of an ellipse. Close to a circle, but this elliptical path, and that idea of elliptical orbits, where over a set of times sweep out the same area, that's the same concept that we still use today. That's some permutations to do tonight's stuff. That's what we do today. To use his calculations, it's a brilliant breakthrough. It takes him another 3 years to write that up. He writes to one of his friends. I mean, what gave him the confidence to spend 3 more years assuming there's an understandable answer out there? Why would you do that? I mean, I can understand spending a few days, but years of your life being sure there was an answer. No one on the planet knows what that answer is, but you're sure it's there. Why? He says to his friend Michael Maitland in one of his letters, he says, the Creator does nothing by chance. It's working? You're kidding me. We're like way into the lecture now, but that's all right. We'll advance these slides and see what we got. Oh, yeah. You guys see that okay? Okay. Yeah, now we're going to have to turn the lights off. I'll finish this in the dark. Oh, not bad. Well, this was really just my illustration of the science versus Christian warfare view. And by the way, it's not just science people who have aggressive bumper stickers like that. How about this one? Express your Christian love truly. Yeah, these bumper stickers are typed in. What are people who say things like this communicating to us? They're saying this mythology of the conflict between science and religion. And it's really that mythology that I want to tear down a little bit. And that's kind of what I've been talking about already. The fact is, in historical fact, science arises out of the Christian worldview, and it's difficult to come up with worldviews that do as good a job even today of supporting science as the Christian worldview does. I have another set of illustrations, actually. I'm not sure these are going to be on the screen. Yeah. I mean, let's just do without this, because I didn't make it the right shape for this screen. So let's just turn the lights back on and I will finish the lecture all on natural. Probably not all natural, but that's
we just appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, I'm sorry. That's not what's going to happen. Y'all didn't pay enough money for that. Okay. So the comprehensibility. I'm so sorry you worked all that time. So, why is the universe orderly? Christianity provides you a good reason for thinking the universe is orderly, because God is a God of reason. Why is the universe comprehensible? Well, Christianity provides you a good reason for thinking that the universe is comprehensible, because God is a rational God. You know, somebody like a lot of skeptics can say, I know it's there. If I work hard enough, I can find it, because I know it's there somewhere. Other worldviews don't always do that. What about this one? Modern science really requires a match between human mathematical insight and the fundamentals of physics. Physics in particular has become extremely mathematical. In fact, we have this famous quote from the 1930s, Paul Dirac, who says, really, in physics, it's more important to have beautiful equations than to have a perfect fit with data. Typically, and I teach with a physics professor, a little Christian, and he says, you hear physicists saying that now. These equations are too ugly to be true. There's a sense of whatever that is, what equation, I'm not enough of a mathematician to know, but there's a certain kind of elegance. And when people are on to that, they realize this just has to be, something like this has to be the correct thing. And we're really driven now by this idea of mathematical insight. And that's because of several things that have happened in which it was mathematical insight that leads the way in making the next breakthrough in physics. One of my favorite stories about this starts back in the mid-1800s. Back in the 1800s, well, still to this day, there are people who do math for fun. And that's shocking to you. I'm glad there are no small children here. People who do mathematics for giggles, just because it's cool. And actually, when I was at Oxford, there was a society of pure mathematics. And according to legend, because they never invited me, but according to legend, their meetings would open with a toast to pure mathematics. May it never be of use to anyone. Which makes sense, right? I mean, we are doing these things just for the beauty of the mathematical operations themselves and the beauty of the ideas that we are working on. And one of those ideas in the mid-1800s was had to do with geometry. Euclid had kind of defined five postulates of geometry, and it worked incredibly well. And there's a sense in which Euclidean geometry is a pretty much a closed science by the time we get to the 1800s. About everything that you can do with Euclid has been done. And so the question is, he's got five postulates. Can you reject or alter one of the five postulates and still get a geometry that works? And so that's the question that's out there, just for the pure mathematicians play around with that. And sure enough, in the mid-1800s, a brilliant, brilliant thinker by the name of Gauss comes up with a geometry that negates the fifth postulate of Euclid and takes a different form, alters it. And that's the one about parallel lines never meeting. He comes up with a kind of meeting at the limit description of what parallel lines might be doing. And it doesn't immediately collapse into self-contradiction. You've actually got a very weird, hard-to-picture geometry, but it doesn't just blow up. And people are really impressed. They're, well done. Yeah, bravo. Let's go on to the next question. And not too long after that, a guy by the name of Riemann, and another, a Russian by the name, I think it's Russian, Lobachevsky, they both publish Gauss's solution is for two-dimensional spaces, and Lobachevsky and Riemann publish for n-dimensional spaces. That is, I can do this non-Euclidean type of geometry. It's really weird, but I can do it for three dimensions. I can do it for four dimensions, five dimensions, whatever that would be, six dimensions, seven. Give me the number you're interested in, give me the n, and I can show you how to do this kind of geometry up to those levels. And so it was really interesting. Again, people said, oh, that's good job. And, you know, so something in pure mathematics, never useful to anyone, goes on the shelf. Move the clock forward. 1905, a patent clerk in Bern, Switzerland, by the name of Albert Einstein, publishes four papers, three of which are absolutely fundamental and change the way we look at the physical world. If one of those, the most famous one probably, is special relativity. And he solves some problems that have been bugging people for about two decades, and he does it in a very mathematically elegant, beautiful way, and it's very exciting. But it's only special relativity. It doesn't deal especially with accelerated frames of reference and so forth. So can you move from special relativity to general relativity? That's the next big trick. And he works on that for 11 years, trying to see if that's possible. And we have letters that he writes during that period. One of the letters, it just sounds like he's had a bad day. He's about to anyway. Compared to the work that I'm trying to do now, that paper on special relativity was child's play. He was really stuck. It was very, very difficult. And one of his colleagues actually showed him the material on n-dimensional, I think it was Riemann's material on n-dimensional non-Euclidean spaces. And as only Einstein could do, the kind of the light came on. And he was able to use that, and actually general relativity uses that kind of non-Euclidean space, the descriptions of space. And it's fundamental, we still use it. Our GPS satellites, they operate on the basis of that all the time. They actually take into account the space, non-Euclidean shape of space when they tell you where you are sitting on the Earth. And so that's just great. I mean, if I believe in God, I totally get why the human mathematical ability should match up with some deep truths of physics. But what if I'm really trying to convince myself that the human brain itself is just kind of a evolved organ, namely designed to move my body around so that my DNA can reproduce more effectively. And that's really all that my brain is. And over here, in a totally different realm, is the fundamental truths of physics. Would I expect it to be any kind of a deep interlocking in that case? Well, the answer is no. Of course not. There's no reason to expect there to be a deep connection.
sort of like if you buy a can opener, because it will open cans for you, and you bring it home, and it turns out it's also an HDTV. I mean, that's just not, that would be weird. You would want some explanation for that. And here we have this tool, this mathematical tool, which has the ability to unlock the secrets of, the deep secrets of the universe. There are a lot of people who have been puzzled, by how that works. Well, it makes sense if you've got the Christian worldview. It's very a deep puzzle if you don't have something like a Christian worldview. Last thing is our human minds themselves, human rationality, up to the task of doing science. I need to have a fairly high confidence that my mind, my rationality, or at least the collective rationality of the scientists that are operating, are up to the task of making sense of the world. Well, what makes me think that's true? Well, we know what made Newton and Galileo and Boyle and Kepler and Copernicus and others think that. They say, God created us. He created the mind, he created the world, and he made a match between them. But what makes us think that our mind really is capable of understanding the world? And on a deep level, on the level that's required for science. This has been... I think the more you move away from the Christian worldview, the more puzzling this gets. In particular, I see this in some of the literature of the modern pop atheists. For instance, if you talk to a pop atheist about the problem of morality, what sure looks like morality is real, and we want people to be moral, it's very hard to how you can make sense of that without a God in the picture somewhere. One of the standard answers you'll get back from the pop atheists today is to say, well, yes, I know that we have a very strong inclination to think that there are moral truths, but that's actually kind of a defect in the way that our brain perceives reality. We are programmed to think that there are moral truths out there, but there aren't really. It's sort of an evolutionarily induced mental defect. And if you talk about free will, it sure seems like I have choice and I can make choices. That doesn't fit at all with a naturalistic viewpoint. And the answer that's usually given is, yeah, you think that you have free will. In fact, you don't. That's an evolutionarily induced defect in you. Your brain is systematically programmed to get that wrong. Again and again and again. And I can go through several of beauty is in the same boat. Even our ability to calculate probabilities is sometimes put in that boat. All of these are designed to kind of push arguments for the existence of God and how, but the cost is again and again and again saying, yeah, but in this area, evolution has created a mismatch between what you're thinking and what reality is like. Evolutionary induced mental defects. Here's the problem. If I'm saying that evolution creates this deeply defective brain for trying to figure out the way reality is, how do I then turn around and claim with any kind of confidence, yeah, but the brain is great for doing science? How do I do that? That doesn't even seem possible for me to turn around and make that claim. If I believe in God, it makes sense for the world and my brain to have some kind of a match. If I'm trying to deny the existence of God, I become less and less and less and less confident that my brain is going to function well, to be able to make sense of the world to the extent that science needs for it to. I'm pretty sure I know the answer to this next question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Did anybody in here see the documentary, A Particle Fever? You saw it?
No.
Oh. So excited. Yeah. Well, you need to go get and rent and watch Particle Fever. I guarantee you it is going to be the most exciting documentary on the discovery of the Higgs boson that you will have watched this year. I promise you that. It's actually really quite good. good if you're super geeky, which I am. It's about the CERN super particle accelerator out in Switzerland and the Large Hadron Collider, thank you. And about the confirmation of the existence of this particle, which our standard theory demands, but we haven't actually had experimental evidence of, so we have a large enough particle accelerator. And spoiler alert, they find it at this school. It was kind of in all the papers in 2007. So, anyway, but I was surprised that they have two physicists arguing with each other in the middle. And did you see it? You didn't raise your hand.
I didn't know that's the title.
I would have article here. I would have given you extra credit. Okay. In the middle, they have these two theoretical physicists. And by the way, anybody in here watch the Big Bang Theory? Oh, yeah, now you watch that. Of course. They actually have the sort of theoretical physicist versus experimental physicist dynamic in the... illustrated in the thing. But anyway, they have these two theoretical physicists. And one of them just states the problem very, very elegantly. He says, you know, what we now know about the story of the Big Bang is true. It has to have been incredibly precisely set out in order to get a universe with matter and sunlight and the possibility of life. I mean, not just a little bit set out. We're talking about two ridiculously precise tolerances in order to get a life-friendly universe. And he says that if once you realize that's true, you kind of have one of two options. He says, either you say there's somebody out here who wanted life really badly and who set up the laws of physics so that life could exist. Or you have to say, we are one of billions and billions and billions and billions of universes. All of them kind of beyond our horizon, we can't see them, we can't detect them directly, but there are billions and billions of universes out there. You either have to choose between a God kind of figure or a multiverse kind of figure to explain this issue of fine-tuning. One of the physicists was on the God side, one of the physicists was kind of on the multiverse side, and the physicist that was on the God side said, see, the reason I don't like multiverses, is it means we can't understand this universe. We can't understand it. It means that essentially the features of this universe, whatever they turn out to be, they had to happen in some universe. And so there's no particular reason to expect there to be a deep explanation or a deep connection. Think about it like this. And this is a huge assault on both comprehensibility and the ability of the human mind to make sense of the world. Think about it like this. There's an Argentinian writer named Jorge Luis Borges. He writes about the library of battle. People just find themselves living in a giant library. Each gallery is sort of a six-sided room with bookshelves lining the outside wall. And there's a banister, and you can look down and you see right below you there's another gallery just like yours. You can look up and you can see there's another gallery just like yours. As far up as you can see, there's galleries. As far down as you can see, there are galleries. And there are either staircases or tunnels leading to other galleries in each corner. So you can go up the staircase, you can go up a floor, find another gallery, you can go down a floor, find another gallery. I love books, that sounds great, and then he tells you the rest of the story. He says, Jorge Luis Borges says, there's just gibberish all over. It's just random letters and punctuation marks and spaces in all the books. Now, the people that live in the library have never found a book that repeats. So the speculation in the library appears to go on forever in all the directions. And the speculation is that every possible book that could exist, every possible arrangement of letters that could exist, exists somewhere in that library. And of course, there are people who have found books that have like a word in them. And that, you know, that becomes like a vacation spot. Let's go over and see the book that has a word. And of course, there are travelers' legends about people who who have found books with a whole sentence in there, right? But nobody has ever, nobody in the world of the story has ever seen that personally. If every conceivable book, every conceivable 200 and, there are 250 pages in each of these, every conceivable arrangement of letters you could fit into 250 pages is in this library, what kind of things are somewhere in the library? What?
Weird things.
So weird things and not weird things. The Nacogdoches, yellow pages. Somewhere in the library, right? Every book that can fit into 250 pages, anyway, is in the library. The Bible, some, or at least 250 pages of the Bible, somewhere in the library, right? The complete works of Shakespeare, it's 250 pages worth, somewhere in the library. Little House on the Prairie, right there somewhere, by sheer randomness, that's going to happen somewhere in the library, right? And this is the weird part. The complete biography of you. Right? Somewhere in the library. Right? In fact, how many of those are there going to be? There's going to be an infinite number of Shakespeare's. There's going to be an infinite number of Bibles. There's going to be Bibles with, you know, the Bible on one page and the Quran mixed in, and then it changes to Moby Dick, and then it's gibberish. There's going to be every possible conceivable arrangement somewhere in the library, and for your life story, it's going to be like that. Suppose you find a book, and you start reading it, and it's about you. I was born in the library, and this is the way my early childhood went, and sure enough, it's all accurate. And you keep following it along, and about page 120, it says, and I found this book, and it told everything step by step that I had done in my life. And then I noticed that on page 120 it says that I found it on page 120. It's incredible. What would you think?
Is that the end of the story?
No, it goes to 250. The 250 pages. So you're right in the middle of your story.
Unbelievable.
Say what?
Say unbelievable.
Unbelievable. Remarkable. Well, it has to be something like that somewhere in the library, right?
Yeah, your chances of
finding it. Yeah, the chances of finding it are far beyond anything you could call astronomical. That's right. But if you did find it, what would you then want to know? You want to turn to the end, right?
Oh, great. I'm a millionaire and I'm the president of the galaxy. And
that's great. Or, you know, I tragically or whatever. If you've read the end of that book, how much do you know that you didn't know before? It's generated by sheer randomness.
Nothing, because there's another book with
a
completely different ending.
In fact, there's probably an infinite number of
other books.
What are the odds that the ending that that book tells you is the real ending of your life? What are the odds? About one out of infinity, or as close to infinity as we can get. It is as close to not, I mean, it is close to certainly not correct as anything can numerically be. Right? And so you know absolutely nothing after you found that book than you knew before. And here's the sad thing. Oh, well, maybe it was on page 120. Oh. Well, the reason why I'm pointing that out is because that's the problem those two physicists, Nina and David Kaplan, are arguing about in Particle Fever. They're saying, if there really were multiverses, then our science is not discovering anything. It's discovering how it happens to be in this particular universe. And there are going to be an infinity of other universes where it's different. And so there's no deep truth to be found here. Science is not doing what you thought it was doing. It's not finding out the actual truth of things. It's just finding out just this accidental piece of data. So that's, there are a lot of people, including really brilliant physicists like Stephen Hawking, who are pushing the multiverse point, but I don't think they're quite coming to grips with the fact that it totally undermines this idea that we are actually comprehending the universe when we make progress. universe is comprehensible, that the human intellect is up to the task of understanding. On the other hand, the God idea does make perfect sense. I don't even have to be perfect as a knower. If I live in a universe that God created for me to know, then I have every confidence that if I keep working at it and keep working at it, I have a chance of finding it out. And even if I'm not the one that finds it out, someone who follows in my footsteps will one day be able to find out. And when we find it in science, we are finding things that are really significant and really true, not just a random series of conflicts. So that to me is incredibly powerful. I have said for a long, long time, science and Christianity are not enemies. Christians make the best scientists because our worldview underwrites science in the most profound possible way. Okay, that's basically what I was going to say in the lecture. I was trying to remember what my slide said as I went along. So, I said I would take questions. So, are there questions?
I didn't really prime you very well for questions.
Yes!
Do you know John Lennox?
Yes! I saw him. I haven't met him, but I saw a video of his, and I really like some of his stuff. John Lennox is a mathematician, Scottish. He's got the greatest accent ever. What have you read some of his stuff or listened to him or whatever?
I love watching him on YouTube.
Oh yeah, man. He's good. He's a good debater too. Yeah, he's worth pursuing a little bit. John Lennox. Yeah. People 600 years ago would call natural philosophy.
But you're exactly right. Today, we kind of have a definition for science that means this, this sort of mechanical, mathematical approach that we kind of really brought to a flower in the scientific revolution of Copernicus to Newton, to Boyle, and that. Yeah. Yes?
Do you believe in an old Earth or a young Earth?
I'm an older Earth guy. Older. I'm an older Earth guy, yeah. You know, I could be wrong, and I've changed my opinion on that because I used to believe more of a young Earth than I do now. Yeah. I've been wrong before.
Kind of pinning on that, you know, I worked at the zoo, and much of my professional life was bathed in evolutionary biology.
Sure, sure.
And the thing about science is it does provide answers.
Yeah.
It does provide links, and it does move beyond deductions.
Yeah.
It does provide answers. And at the same time, I'm amazed when I read terminology how often the word, this is in peer review, maybe, could be, possibly, theorized as.
Sure.
We know that has to be the case.
Sure.
It's like I say, you can't prove something.
Right.
But there is, obviously, if you go one step, it just works by the misdirection. But it does explain a lot of what I do and connections, but at the same time, severe limitations. So you get into recognizing the limitations of science, then you hear politicalization things like climate change. And you just, so then you get where you, I don't know, is this guy just because of who he is? Or, that's not fair either.
No.
So it'd be nice to be able to navigate what is good science, bad science,
That is a tough deal. It really is. I do not think science is the enemy of faith. That doesn't mean that there are not areas of tension, because there are some areas of tension for sure. But I think we've really misunderstood. I mean, as I argued this morning, every time science makes an advancement and puts two and two together that weren't put together before, that's evidence of a rational creation. That's evidence of a mind behind nature that has made it possible for nature to not be just a mass of chaos, but for it to actually have a rational order. And so I think we need to learn as Christians to welcome the advances of science. Even evolutionary science is very exciting, and it makes possible a lot of connections, even if it turns out to be ultimately wrong as an overall theory, which I think we probably will. That's just my opinion. I think it's amazing how much it is able to explain.
Two good questions.
You guys didn't need any PowerPoints. Yeah, go ahead.
I have a weird question. I can remember probably in the 90s, maybe it had to be in the 90s, but there was a set of but they had something where they brought in these scientists and they proved that the Red Sea parting could happen and water turning into wine could happen. As a Christian, I don't know what I'm trying to say. One, I can never find those videos again.
Oh, yeah.
I've tried to look for them. I can't find them, even with Google out there now. But, as a Christian, and that whole faith thing and just believing in miracles. I mean, I want the scientific side of me wants to say, we can prove this. This actually happened.
Yeah.
But from the Christian side, I want to have the faith to not have to have a scientific approach to prove that miracles happen like that.
Right, right.
I guess I'm making more of a statement than a question. But
no, that's good. That's a good comment. Yeah, I think that, again, I don't think there's a fundamental divide between these two areas. Now, there is a fundamental divide between Christianity and naturalism, or Christianity and scientism. But those are philosophies, and they're ultimate worldviews. Science itself is a set of techniques and a set of approaches to how we gain knowledge. There's not a conflict between that and, at least not a fundamental one, between that and Christianity. There can be individual conflicts as science, it's tentative, it's progressive, it comes up with things and they stand for a while and then they fall away. And some of the things that science comes up with can be, in tension with what Christians hold. And I think that's okay. So
some of the stuff science comes up with is in tension with other stuff in science. You know, that's part of the deal. Because it is tentative, it's pushing out. And so, you know, you can just as a Christian say, well, this part lines up pretty well, this part over here not so well. And as a Christian, you know, this makes me happy and this makes me puzzled, but I'm going to be puzzled.
So do you believe that, do you believe in evolution, that we evolved?
I'm not convinced of the full story of evolution, but I am convinced that there's evolution going on, that God used the process of evolution as part of how he made us. You know, I said this morning that if you've understood genetics, it almost falls out as a given that God would build in genetic adaptability into the creatures he makes. Because, you know, a smart God would do that because he knows the environment's going to change, and so he builds in some adaptability. And that's why we see lots and lots of that. When people say evolution hasn't been proved, they're usually talking about the giant theory, sort of dust to the humans theory. But that evolution happens has been proved again and again and again. And we see lots of evidence of it. That's why we have drug-resistant bacteria. Penicillin won't cut much ice now. And it was great when I was a kid. It worked really well. Thanks to horrible work. Great. Now, you know, you get penicillin and it just kind of bounces off the super bugs. Say what?
That's it, really?
Oh.
I mean, it's like a lot of the earlier drugs, getting resistance to bacteria and moving on from that. Now they go back.
You can come back and kill some of those.
Which is nice. Now, that always may not work, but
yeah.
It certainly does. Of course, talk about the science and the overuse of antibiotics and food. Centers of habits in the human which and a lot of those. So there is, we rely on science. So much, and we really need to embrace that aspect.
Yeah.
Same time, the lens is on the same way.
Yeah.
Well, it's settled. That's what I guess. You hear that.
That's right.
All this time. Science is settled. Science is settled. No. It's not.
Sometimes, that's exactly right. Sometimes people want to use science as a club in the culture. Either side may want to use a piece of science as a way to make a little progress in the culture wars, or even to score political points occasionally. But you know, science itself, as I said, is just this technique. It works better if you already believe the world is orderly, comprehensible. It kind of opens itself up to our investigation. Now, it does have some assumptions in it that I think are difficult. As a scientist, you do have to operate as if God's not directly involved in the world. You have to kind of operate as if everything has a natural cause. But that doesn't mean that that's the way the world really is. That's just the best way to do science. And the reason why it's worth doing it that way, even if you're a Christian, it's really worth doing science as a natural scientist, is because the job of science is to find all the places that does work. And almost the only way to find out where it doesn't work is to find out all the places where it does work. So I advocate for that. And that's intentional, because that rules out some of the things we know are actually true. Yeah.
I'm a little bit confused. I am a Christian, and it's hard for me to relate to someone who doesn't believe.
Right.
I don't understand how a scientist can remove God from the equation and still believe that his five senses are supposed to make sense for something. I don't understand if just a process of evolution has caused us, and we're just pops and fizzes in our head, that's all that we really are, then how can we really believe that there are laws of logic, laws of science? How can we use those things if we don't take into account where they came from and how they work?
Yeah.
I understand you said that they just ignore that and want to do science, but if they're actually looking for truth, then how can they ignore that?
Yeah. Well, I'm just telling you what actually happens. Maybe you can just ignore that.
And they call us intellectually. the basics of their own.
That's right. Nobody, I mean, human beings just don't answer every question that presents itself. We have short lifespan relative to this world. We pursue what we pursue. Sometimes that's just prejudice.
Sir, you're going to hitting out this question. Because God is an explanation somewhere beyond logic and order, you know, in an evolutionary sense, it would make sense in a think tank. I mean, it really happened. That those who can recognize, think, are going to survive more than those who don't. I get full simplification. And certainly, those who are, in an evolutionary sense, have a reasoning sense, pass those genes on to those who
don't.
And that kind of thing. So eventually, over the eons, we have the ability to survive, adapt to our environment by way of thinking, by way of reasoning, by way of. And then it makes sense that, you know, the world, we don't need morals, if I kill you, you know, that's not good for society, so we have then come. They're going to come up with explanations.
Yes, some people do come up with those explanations. I think that's interesting. The one you gave for knowledge, yeah, I mean, some people have said creatures that have a major mismatch between the way they think and the way the world is have the admirable trait of dying off and not passing on their genes. So that's the evolutionary explanation. But if you, and if you're already an evolutionist, that satisfies you. You don't ask any more questions. But if you aren't, you begin to probe that a little bit. And you say, okay, well, what am I actually getting if that was my theory of why I was smart? If I'm literally saying, okay, it's only the kind of intelligence that evolution could build into me. What is evolution interested in? If it has an interest, what's it? Reproduction. That's right. The winners in evolution are those who can get their DNA more fully into the next generation. People say, well, human beings are obviously the fittest creatures on the planet, survival of the fittest. We must have the best, you know, fit of our mind to the world. Well, number one, fittest creatures on the planet means who can produce more DNA more quickly? Are we the fittest creatures on the planet? Not even close. Cockroaches killing us. A bunch of other beetles killing us. Paradise killing us. And so we are not anywhere close to the fittest species on the planet. So by that measure, nevertheless, they say, well, we have a very, very complex nervous system. And the reason why we survive is because of the brain we have, not because of our claws or teeth or stripes or anything. And so maybe our brain really has been too. What?
And we can step on
it. Although it usually doesn't work.
I'm not sure that the most intelligent passing their DNA all makes sense either. I've been at the Walmart.
Well, but let's go back to this. What am I actually getting if I'm truly saying it's evolution that's making me smart enough to do science? Evolution is going to favor those traits which help me pass on my DNA. That's what it's going to do. Every time. We have lots of examples where evolution is notorious for taking intellectual shortcuts. I mean, there's a whole actual group of wasps that prey on caterpillars. There's a sex wasp and several cousins of the sex wasp. This is so creepy. I'm glad you guys have all heard of me. But basically, the sex wasp will hunt caterpillars of certain types. And they will sting them, but their poison paralyzes but doesn't kill. So you've got a paralyzed caterpillar, many times larger than the wasp. The wasp can't fly with it, so it will drag painstakingly across to its burrow. This is a wasp that burrows into the ground. And it will go down into the burrow, check to make sure nothing's there, come back out, bring the caterpillar that's paralyzed down into its burrow, and then, this is the creepy part, lay its eggs into the body cavity of this paralyzed but still living caterpillar. So then when the eggs hatch, free meat all around them, and the new baby sex wasps can be nourished at the expense of a living caterpillar. I know, it's creepy, huh? Okay. Well, I told you all that just to tell you this. So that little behavior of bringing the caterpillar up to the burrow, dropping it, and then going down and checking the burrow, turns out that if you move the caterpillar just an inch, the wasp will come out. It won't be where it expects it. It will look for it, grab it, bring it back up to that same preset distance, and check the burrow again. But it just checked, you know, a half a second earlier. And if you move it again, it'll come back out. It won't be where it expects it. Go find it, drag it up to that same preset distance, and check the burrow again. And, you know, the reports say the behavior is never extinguished. What that means is some poor graduate student had to sit there moving the caterpillar and recording the results again and again and again and again. Well, could you make a smarter wasp? You know, a wasp that would eventually catch on. You know, hey, and then graduate student moving my caterpillar. Could you make a smarter wasp? Yeah, you could, but what would be the cost in evolutionary terms? Well, maybe. Find a more humane way to raise your young. But if you made a smarter wasp, that would require more neural circuitry, right? You have to build in a bigger brain wherever they keep their brains. And neural circuitry is incredibly nutrition seeking. It's the most sugar intensive of any of our body parts, how much energy you have to provide to keep our neural circuitry working. So you'd have a wasp with more tissue, heavier, flies slower. You'd have a wasp that has to eat a lot more in order to be smart enough to overcome it. That's not a tough choice for evolution to make, is it? Because how often is the whole graduate school moving the caterpillar? Graduate student moving the caterpillar thing going to come up in the normal struggle for survival. In the normal struggle for survival, pass on your DNA, who would you bet on? The smart wasp that's fat and slow and hungry? Or the lean, mean, but pretty dumb wasp? Which one is actually going to do better? Well, that's a no-brainer. You know that evolution is going to select for what's most likely to occur, and that's what is actually happening. And that's what would be happening with us if evolution wrote a full story about how we got our friends. And we would know that. And in fact, you see, as I pointed out, you see evolution. The point is, if I actually gave you power, in my mind, it was all there. You know, evolutionists would go to that well sometimes, or people who are rejecting religion and the idea of God would go to that well again and again and again and say, well, the reason you think there's morality when there really isn't is because of, you know, this defect that's programmed into you and so forth. So, if you probe that a little bit, it just starts crumbling. That whole idea that, yeah, we're smart because evolution made us smart. Not smart enough to do that kind of science we're being asked to do.
Are you talking about microevolution or macroevolution?
I don't know how to make that distinction, macro and micro.
Macro is like whenever it goes from a like human and from like bacteria's fungus to the thing. Macro is
I know how the terms are used, but it's very hard for me to see how you can draw a sharp distinction between those two. Just because every single step in an evolutionary story is a micro step, usually. And the whole claim is that, you know, if you add up enough micro steps, you get a really surprising macro change. So I don't know. I don't know how to make that distinction. Good question. Yeah.
Have you ever seen a scientist who's a naturalist, an evolutionist, that actually lives as though they are? They live as though there's no morality? They live as though...
There are creepy examples. I mean, that's a... Yeah, I don't know.
I hear them say it in a place, but I've never seen an atheist or a...
It would be rare to have somebody try and do that. And the reason is because the natural evangelistic story is a false story. The true story is that we have within us the image of God, the logos of God, and I live that way even if I am denying in the process that there is God. I live as if the logos is true. I live as if morals really matter, and living, you know, a noble life really matters. I don't live up to it always, but that's what I try to do. And every human being does that. And, you know, an intellectual breakdown here and there is a small price to pay to continue to do that. So people, yeah, I don't see it very often. People, thank goodness, are better than their philosophies. A lot of times.
I can't really hear what people are saying.
I'm sorry, I should have repeated that. Yeah. He asked it to people. Do naturalists ever sort of try to live out their philosophy and say, you know, well, if morals are fake and we're all just kind of dusts in the wind, then we can do whatever we want. And people don't act like that usually. I mean, you have the example of Nietzsche where he said that's what we should all do, and he actually didn't do it. Say what?
To be a sociopath, really.
Yeah, yeah, and if you're a sociopath, that's just a problem with your development. It's not a philosophy. You can have Christian, Muslim, Jewish, you know, atheist sociopaths.
Well, I was just thinking of the character Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment. He tried that.
Yeah.
It works a lot.
He tried to be a philosophical nihilist. Right. And, you know, commit murder in a philosophical way. And the old lady needed to die, but... she's a horrible person, but it just, it blows him up. And of course, my favorite Dostoevsky novel is The Brothers Karamazov, and it's a good example of this.
Dostoevsky is just so good.
Just like Particle Fever would be the best documentary on the search. It goes on. You watch this here. The Brothers Karamazov would be the best 1,000-page Russian novel that you read this year. In that, the smartest person by far in every room he's in is a character, Ivan Karamazov. And Dostoevsky's a Christian. He really disagrees with Ivan's position. He never has him sort of meet his match in the story where somebody kind of debates him down with his religion or anything like that. Ivan is always the smartest person in the room. And he asserts this thing that says, you know, once we realize that there is no God, once you know God is dead, everything is primitive. And he asserts that early in the story, and there's a whole bunch of sub-stories where that works out in different ways for different people. Dostoevsky never has him refuted by arguments, but he does kind of have him refuted by life, because at the end of the story...
Is this a spoiler alert?
This is a spoiler alert. I'm sorry. I know it's only been out for 120 years. So I feel bad. This is the very end of the story, so it's not spoiling everything. At the very end of the story, Ivan literally cracks up. I mean, he starts talking to the devil. The devil starts showing up and taking tea with him and having these philosophical arguments and stuff, and he's going crazy. And here's what's driving him crazy. He wants to do a noble action. He wants to go in and confess to a murder that he didn't actually commit to save his own brother, which is good. Logos, it's, you know, the image of God within us. I want to do something noble. But the way he's defined the universe, his philosophy says, there's nothing that's either noble or evil. Everything is just dust in the wind. Everything that happens is equivalent to everything else that happens. And so that's what's actually driving him crazy by the end of the book. He is literally crazy by the end of the book because he wants desperately to live, in spite of the fact that there is no God, he believes. He wants to live as if life has meaning and noble choices are to be admired, and he realizes his own philosophy has just worked the doubts out for every life. He's nuts. He is nuts. It's a great novel. It's a great novel. It's a way funnier than you would think for a Russian novel. It's really, it's just a hoot. Well, okay, probably that's exactly. It's funny. It's funny. Well, we've gone on long enough. Any other questions? I can't tell if you're giving me the eye or not, Curtis. Yeah, go ahead.
One thing, I appreciate people like you that think about science and evolution and God and the Bible and all that kind of stuff. I've always had trouble with evolution. Maybe some friends in college that were atheists.
Right.
So I rejected any kind of evolution.
Right.
So, yeah. But now that I understand more, and you help me understand more, the books I read help me understand more, it makes more sense now. So I'm becoming more comfortable with all of this. And it really helps my faith.
Well, good.
It's stronger because of that.
Yeah.
So I just want to say that, science can, I believe in science, and I believe in God.
Yeah.
I believe, that it all intermingles together. It's just that it doesn't have to be so far as I can understand about evolution. And it's part of science. I mean,
we're
involved.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this is true or not, but I was told that Roman soldier a long time ago, 2,000 years ago, was only like 5'2 or 5'3.
Yeah.
And they were actually short.
Yeah.
And now we're 6 feet.
Yeah, pretty close.
Think it's their job.
I'm not, but yeah. Some of you are.
So, it's just that there is evolution.
Yeah. Whether that would. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and you don't have to take everything that science tells you as proven. I wouldn't. Because science by its nature is a tentative, is a questing out into what we don't yet know, trying to figure it out. I think Christians are the best equipped to do that kind of questing work, but it is just questing. I am making a tentative hypothesis, I'm doing the best I can just to make it more certain, but sometimes it breaks down even after a long, long time. So even scientists and even atheists take some of science with a grain of salt. It's a bit of a judgment call. So I'm not here preaching that you have to agree with the whole theory of evolution. I don't even agree with all of that. I certainly don't. And you just have to kind of work your way through as you go. Oh, that would be awesome. Thank you.
You guys have questions you want to address there? We'll be here until about 2 in the morning.
What? Whatever.